You see, the contemplations are the methods for gaining insight. And obviously, the calmer the mind, the easier it is to gain insight. So a good a method is to first do calm meditation, that is, try to stay focused on the breath, or if you can do the absorptions, stay focused on that, and follow that with a contemplation. So first calm, then insight. It's easier that way. However, if the mind is not willing to become calm, if it's playing around and going all over the place, do contemplation instead. That's fine. Either way, there are many methods, but there are only two directions, calm and insight. And a little bit of calm brings a bit of insight, and a bit of insight brings a bit of calm. And if you add the bits together, eventually, hopefully, there'll be a lot of both. And so if the mind, and there are different days, sometimes the mind starts thinking about things and just won't let go. One gets a feeling sometimes that if it was a dog gnawing a bone and doesn't want to let go of that bone, even though the bone has absolutely nothing on it anymore. It's there. And so then the time has come for contemplation. And we have done one contemplation so far, which is a fine substitute for calm meditation, because it also brings calm. But one can also, if the mind is, as I say, upset or very discursive, use the impermanence of the breath as a meditation subject. It doesn't have to be, I'm now going to be calm. It's a fine intention, but it doesn't always work. So one has to have different options. And I have suggested that many times to people in courses. One has to have also a bit of an imagination and a bit of understanding about oneself. What would be the best thing to do right now? Because if you, for instance, sit down and you want to become calm and want to be concentrated, and it just doesn't happen, what's the result? The result is frustration, or anger, or total disappointment. And in the long run, then, the result is, I can't meditate. I'll have to do something else. Well, what else? There is no substitute for meditation. There are lots of other things one can do, but nothing substitutes. There's no substitute for training the mind. So all these ideas come about because things don't work the way they are supposed to. Last year, I asked Sarah, my granddaughter, who was 4 then, said, why is she screaming? She was screaming a lot then still. Now she's given that up a bit. And she says, nothing works the way it's supposed to. I said, that's right. That's absolutely correct. But you think screaming is going to help? So we had a long discussion about that. So frustration doesn't help, so it doesn't work the way it's supposed to. That's right. That's the first noble truth. Existence is dukkha. So screaming doesn't help, frustration doesn't help, trying to do something else doesn't help, nothing helps. All one has to do is see whether one can approach the same thing from a different angle. And usually one can. So there's the option of doing contemplation, and then there's the option of using the mind as a watching the breath as impermanent. And also there is that option that when we do that, watch the breath as impermanent, that we can also see how the thoughts are impermanent. They arise and they cease. There's no way that can be changed. They always do. Which is the reason why we write things down, because we can't. What we think one moment is gone the next. So when we see, for instance, those two things within us as impermanent, we also lose a little bit of our solidity feeling, lose a little bit of this feeling of this compactness, that there is really somebody there. Now with mindfulness, and we have by no means exhausted mindfulness yet, there is far more to it yet, with mindfulness I have already mentioned that one should do that outside of the meditation. It's very important. And the two things that mindfulness provides, mindfulness of any of the foundations provides, which is the being in the here and now. I mean, it doesn't matter whether you watch the body or whether you watch the mind or whether you watch the contents, all of that, any mindfulness provides the experience of being here now, and also any mindfulness provides purification. So those two are not specific to mindfulness on the body, they are just specific to being totally observant, keen observer, really understanding. The more we're able to be calm, the easier it is to be mindful, of course. But if we don't practice mindfulness, we're not going to become calm. So it's really a catch-22, isn't it? It's either we've got to do it, and then it will follow. So we have two things which happen whenever we are really observing. But as far as the body is concerned, the body mindfulness, we have some extra results which can come. And the first one, which is a very important one, is that mind and body are two. I did mention it already, but I want to repeat it, because it's the first step in insight. Not to have that feeling or understanding that they've got to be one. They've got to be in one place, but they're two. And the mind is the one that looks after everything. It reacts to the body, that's quite true, but it's in charge. And this is something that one should never forget, because if one doesn't forget that, one will not forget meditation. Because it's the only way we can train the mind. There's no other way. We can get knowledge, we can learn things, we can try to understand difficult concepts, but training the mind to do what we want it to do, we only learn through meditation. So when we realize that our mind is in charge of our life, well, that might make all the difference in the world, what we do with our mind. So that's the first thing which happens on the inside path. Mind and body are two. Mind's in charge. The other thing is that through the understanding of what's happening in when we're mindful of the body, we come nearer to that understanding that we are not actually something separate from the rest of the world. And the element contemplation is supposed to help on that. That we don't feel ourselves so separate. If we don't feel ourselves so separate, we also lose some of that idea that is only me. This body. It isn't only me. Everybody's got a body like that. So we have the contemplation of the elements, which shows that not only other people's bodies trees and grass and earth and clouds and oceans and everything has the same body. They all got the same elements. See, the water, for instance, also has earth element in it. Because if it didn't, one couldn't go with a boat over it or swim in it. It's also got solidity. In fact, it's the heaviest thing there is. It's not just water. It certainly has temperature. So all elements and contain all elements. And so do we. And I mean, if you look at yourself or all the other people around, can you see that they're almost 80% water? Well, I can't. Not with my eyes, I can't. But I'm sure you remember from school that we were taught that. So our optics are totally unsatisfactory. They don't tell us a thing. We can't look beyond the horizon, and we can't look around the corner. And we can't see what bees can see. They can see ultraviolet light. We can't see that. I mean, we've got eyes just enough to read and write, and most people even need glasses for that. So there's a whole lot of water sitting around here. Interesting, isn't it? But because water has the function of adherence, of holding things together, it appears to be one solid entity. Now, I often say, and I've often thought that if that wasn't the case, if that wouldn't be the way it is, then maybe all our cells would be separate and they'd all be walking around separately. And maybe we would have an easier time of it, seeing that there wasn't anybody there, there are just all these cells walking around. But then on second thought, I came to the conclusion that we would probably pick the biggest and best looking of the cells and say, that's me. But if you can think for a moment that they'd all be, you know, sort of hopping around separately and actually mingling with other cells that are all over the place, because they make, you know, connection with others, and one gets an idea. And this is what I said yesterday. Imagine what it's like not to feel this is me. It's such a relief, you know. Things are just happening. They're always happening. Everything is always happening. It's got to happen because it's impermanent. So something new has to happen. Yesterday's day is over with, so today has to happen. Unless the whole universe collapses, today has to happen. There's always something happening, because it's all impermanent, something new comes about, but that's all. We don't have to interfere, and we don't have to put ourselves into it. It happens anyway. So the element contemplation can and should be helpful to create a bit of this unity consciousness, which I have mentioned as part of the higher absorptions, which we will come to later, but which can be also explained through this. Maybe not to a total degree, I'm sure not, but certainly at least in understanding that everybody's having these elements. And all the elements out there, they also have them. And wherever you see somebody, now for instance, somebody's very unpleasant, huh? It happens, people are unpleasant. And you can feel the anger arising about this person, what the person is doing and the person, him or herself. You remember that he or she is made up of the four great elements, and all you can do is smile. So which element are you getting worried about? Which one are you getting angry at? Or preferably the water one, because he or she consists of most of that. Huh? Well, who gets angry at water? You know, this is a thing that happens if one practices diligently. You practice it over and over again, and you can't forget anymore. In our daily lives, things confront us. I'm confronted with just as many things as everybody else, but I can't forget anymore. I can't forget ever anymore that everybody has the same bits and pieces and everybody is made up of the same elements. So getting angry is actually ridiculous. What are we getting angry at? So that's why practice has to be constant, over and over again. And the reason it has to be over and over again and has to be constant and is this: we are thinking in a different way, right? We see everybody separate. And we see this person is nice and this one isn't, and this one is likes me and this one doesn't like me, and all these kind of things. So what we have to do is slowly turn that kind of reaction to a different direction. Well, you don't take that kind of reaction that we've been having for the decades now and just turn it around and say, well, no, they're all elements and that's it. You can see it, but you can't do it. Slowly, little by little. And you've done it long enough, nothing to it. It's a matter of course. The same goes for, and now that's why I'm also saying, please use this contemplation also in other times during the day, and keep on using it. It doesn't have to take as long as we took yesterday. You can take your own time. You can use one of the elements. You don't have to use all four. Whichever one you like, doesn't matter. You don't have to use my way of doing it. These are only suggestions. You can use your own way of doing it. Imagine yourself standing next to a tree and then do it with a tree. Or don't even imagine it. Go and stand next to a tree if there's a bit of shade there. And then see what happens when you think of it in that way. Not to think of a nice tree or a beautiful tree and a big tree or a gum tree or nothing like that. The elements, huh? So use your own imagination and your own abilities. Everybody has certain tendencies and abilities, and we should, especially on this path, use those that are most useful for us, most helpful. So if we have a good imagination, and I know some of you do have, use it. But use it in those directions for calm and insight. And if you have a very logical, analytical mind, okay, analyze. What's this tree made of? What am I made of? So if you're very visual, visualize. Whatever it is, whatever you can do well. And you will also find that you can do things well which you thought you couldn't do at all, but because you'd never tried them. I had that experience not long ago, well, it's about 2 years ago now. I thought I couldn't draw a straight line. I had an experience when I was a little kid. In those days, our schools were a bit, well, very autocratic. And I don't know, 6 or 7 years old, and we were supposed to draw the witch and Hänsel and Gretel, which I did, just as I was supposed to, for my homework. And I got a 4, which is the last but worst number you can get. And underneath it said, do it again. So I went to my mother, and I said, I can't do any better than this. Can you do it for me? She said, oh, sure. So she sat down, and she did it. And she got a 5. So after that, I gave up. Which is like, Lord, 65 years ago. And I never drew another line. And then I told the story to Nana Bodhi, whom a number of you know, and he said, ah, nonsense, everybody can draw. And he bought me a drawing pad and some watercolors. And of course at first it looked awful, but it came to the point where I thought, gee, it looks great. I didn't know I could draw. So what we haven't done, we think we can't do. But that's what we, this kind of sort of imagination and ability that all of us have, we need to really bring it to our practice. If we have a mind that likes to have clarity, go step by step to find out which way it really runs. If we have, as I said before, logical, analytical mind, use it. Some people are more inclined to feeling. Well, use it. Use it. Feel the tree. Feel the water and liquidity in you. So it's important to keep on, to persevere. Now that is one thing that will help us for unity consciousness. And I'm sure that the word is not difficult. It means that we know that we belong in a large creation. Does that word give you any problem, the word creation? It's a manifestation of everything. I lived for 10 years in Sri Lanka. I know the problems they have with words. It's a word that they associate with Christianity, the word creation. But if you take one look around you, just one look, house, people, chairs, garden, tree, what is it? It's creation, isn't it? The house was created by a builder and an architect. People are created because they come from father and mother. And the Buddha doesn't uses them, they're caused by food. So this unity feeling that we are part and parcel of everything that exists helps enormously to allay fears. People are, strangely enough, fearful of other people. They want to be appreciated. They want to be understood. They want to be loved. They want to be considered knowledgeable. Want to be considered important. They want a support system from other people. And that's extremely debilitating. Since practically everybody is doing it, wanting this support system, practically nobody has any energy and time left over to give a support system. So everybody is looking for it. So that kind of stance, and it's enormously widespread, I would say that, well, I don't know, I'm guessing, but 95% of humanity suffers from this. And many nonsensical things are done because of that. It gives a great feeling of, a very constant feeling of insecurity, because they're always looking for somebody to disprove that insecurity. Well, who can disprove it? I mean, it's not possible. We can only do that ourselves. So one thing which helps there is that feeling of being part of everything. Even though we are, each one of us, an a tiny part of everything, very tiny, you can hardly see it. we're still part of the whole thing. So there's nothing there that could possibly threaten us. And when we realize that, when we don't feel so threatened, we also don't have so much desire for a support system. We feel more at ease, we feel more secure, we feel more solid within us. So that, again, that contemplation helps us in that respect. Now the other thing that it does, and this is going for insight, and that's why not only the contemplation but also the mindfulness brings insight. Not only those two things which I said already, purification and being in the here and now, which are not strictly inside steps, the inside step being mind and body being two, but the other inside step which mindfulness brings, and particularly body mindfulness, is when you use the elements and the parts of the body which we'll use. Who is the me? Is a water element me, fire element me, earth element me, all wind element, all four together? Which one of those elements tells me it's me? It can only be the mind telling me it's me. It can't be the elements. So if the elements are not saying it's me, then why do I have to believe it when the mind tells me? The more we get involved with seeing ourselves as elements, the less we are involved with seeing this body as me. Now, I'm sure everybody is quite willing to accept the fact that we are not really this body. But we are also concerned with the fact that we live in this body. Well, there's no doubt about it. The body carries the mind around. But I said already yesterday, and I'd like to repeat that, we all live in a house, but nobody thinks that they are that house. We live in it. We are not that house. We use it. We need it. It needs to protect us from the weather, and it needs to shelter us. But we couldn't possibly be that such a house. I mean, nobody has that crazy idea that they're a house, huh? But the body is a house. That's all it is. And obviously, just as we clean up the house, we clean up the body, there's no doubt about it. And just as we try to keep the house in the best condition, so we try to keep the body in the best condition. Most people eventually can't do it anyway. The body has its own methods and has its own way of falling apart because of the elements. The elements that are in the body, for instance, the fire element. A fire element is the element that destroys. Just like fire destroys. So we can do the best we can with this house we live in, but we mustn't identify with it. And if you do that often enough, by becoming very much aware of the fact that mind and body are two, and that the mind is living in the body, there's no doubt about that, but doesn't have to say that this is me, the easier it becomes to remember that in daily living. Now, in daily living, you can't say such a thing to other people, obviously. They'll get irate about it, or they'll say it's nonsense. But in our confrontations with other people, if we remember that it isn't this body at all that counts. I mean, does it really matter what sort of house you live in? Does it have a three-bedroom house or a two-bedroom house or a four-bedroom house or two bathrooms or three bathrooms or just one bathroom. I mean, it doesn't really matter, does it? I mean, it's just a house that one has to live in. So does it really matter what sort of body we live in, as long as we keep it in order, or as best order as we possibly can? So in our daily confrontations, if we do remember that, then we are also not so terribly concerned with getting everything for the body that we think we should have, and that's mostly comfort. We want comfort for the body, which doesn't mean we should want discomfort. Not at all. What it means is that we can do with whatever there is. If, for instance, we live in a house which has only one bathroom, and we're four people, well, we'll have to do with one bathroom. We can't go around complaining constantly. Or we'll have to build a bathroom or something. But it's useless to keep on complaining, saying, "Ah, there's only one bathroom, it's terrible. I want to get in there. There another person is in there." Well, that makes life miserable. The same with the body. If we pay too much attention and too much identification with the body, it makes life miserable. Because the body has constant demands. It's never quite comfortable. It has, sometimes it's, it's hungry and wants to eat. Okay? So it gets some food and then it feels too full. So figures can't, mind says can't meditate, body's tummy is too full. Okay. Have to wait till that abates again. Then it's thirsty. Then it's tired. Then it's too hot. Then it gets a knee ache and a backache and a headache. And starts sniffling and coughing. And there's always something wrong. And then we get over that. You know, I'm finished with the sniffling and coughing and the backache. No, it thinks of something else. There's no doubt about it that something else appears. We have finally settled down, sat down, nice and quiet. And then the mind is restless. And then the body becomes restless too. So the body is almost a constant source of discomfort. And we are almost constantly concerned with getting it comfortable. And it isn't a useful proposition. We'll never make it. Now, not to misunderstand, it's totally useless to be uncomfortable for meditation. We should start out our meditation being comfortable in mind and body. That's what the Buddha said. But if we ever get concentrated, and even only for short periods of time, we don't notice the discomfort anymore that the body has. It's not uncommon, in fact it's very common, that somebody who has been concentrated and hasn't felt any discomfort in the body finishes with the meditation and the whole body aches. So the discomfort in the body can be overcome by constant movement. Now the word discomfort is of course dukkha. And dukkha is always overshadowed by movement, by getting away from it. And it's a dead end street. We can't get away from it because it comes back, always comes back. So the real thing with the body, the important thing, is to see that it actually generates dukkha, that it is dukkha, and the wish that it shouldn't be makes more dukkha. Now that's a very important way to look at it, because the wish that the body should not make dukkha is behind everything we do when we have the slightest discomfort or have illnesses. That doesn't mean we shouldn't take medicine. The Buddha said medicine is one of the four requisites. But the wish in the mind that it must under no circumstances make dukkha for us, this body, that we must simply find something that will get us out of that, that is a total identification with the body. So if we recognize the fact that the body provides dukkha, we have taken a step in insight. And it is another mindfulness of the body, to become aware how this body feels. And then we accept this. We accept the fact that the body creates dukkha. Not constantly, but always off and on. And then we realize the fact that this is what bodies do. And then we realize the fact that everybody has it. And then we don't have that feeling of separation. And we don't have that feeling of, look at that person, oh, they can sit nicely, I can't. Envy. Everybody's got dukkha. Sometimes the dukkha is small, sometimes it's medium size, sometimes it's large size, but it's always there. The body has its own type of reactions. If you sit long enough in one place, maybe it has to be 2 or 3 hours or 5 hours, doesn't matter, it's bound to be dukkha. Or maybe it has to be 20 minutes, I mean, who knows. There's got to be dukkha. It has its own reactions. But when the mind understands this and accepts it, it says, all right, well, it's the first noble truth, isn't it? That everything is that exists has dukkha in it, unsatisfactoriness in it. And I'm only adding to that dukkha by the craving of wanting to get rid of it. If I were to accept it just the way it is, it wouldn't at all bother me. And then we would see ourselves in a more realistic way. As long as we identify with the body, we see ourselves as a body. Just as I said, we are not a house, so obviously it's just as nonsensical as identifying with the house we live in. So having seen that and understood that, we then have this other problem that we think we own the body. And there we can use our mindfulness and our keen observation, because that's the same thing, mindfulness and keen observation, to recognize the fact that if we really owned it, why doesn't it do what we want it to do? Sometimes it does, but most of the time it has its own method of doing things. It has its own nature. So what we are looking at when we are thinking of an I own this body, we are again looking at a mental formation, a mind-made thought and idea. And then we can see whether a thing which creates dukkha, why do we want to own it? I mean, isn't that pretty foolish? Why do we want to be the owner of that? I mean, anything that creates dukkha, we'd rather get rid of, wouldn't we? So why make such a show of owning this thing and being identified with it and thinking of it in a way as it's beautiful or it's ugly or it's handsome or it should be taller or shorter or fatter or thinner or whatever? Why do we think of it that way? I mean, it's silly, isn't it, to want to own something that definitely creates dukkha, that definitely doesn't listen to whatever we want it to do, namely, stay well, never get sick, don't have any back aches or knee aches, nothing, don't have anything, just be nice and quiet and don't show any kind of discomfort, and don't bother me ever. Why doesn't it do that sort of thing? So why own it? If we come to the conclusion that it's totally unnecessary to be the owner of this, what do? We take a step back from it and we have more objective observation of the body. It just is. It has arisen through the craving that we want to be, which is our strongest craving. A craving for existence. Bhava, tanha in Pali, we want to be. Tanha is craving and bhava is being, craving for being. That's how the body comes about. That's how we get born. Maybe if we get that clear, we also don't worry about anymore where we were born and what parents we had and all that, because we picked the whole thing. We made it all happen. Parents are only the vehicles. We made the whole thing happen. It's in some respects, this is such an different way of looking at it that many people, while they can elect intellectually affirm this, they can't use it. People are so very much ingrained with the idea that whatever is happening to them now is caused by their parents' inability to bring them up properly or whatever, or love them properly. We pick the parents that we need, and that's what goes on then. And of course the parents also need that kind of lesson. So the ownership of the body comes about, first of all, everybody thinks that way. I mean, we are very much influenced by the way other people think. But it also comes about because we're using it. We're making use of it. And we are not only making use of it, but we have this identification problem. I mean, we identify with being a woman or a man, an old or young, beautiful, ugly, clever, stupid, whatever. We have all sorts of identification problems. Now, as long as we identify with owning this body, the problem of self is massive, because the body is really there to be seen. And if I own that and really identify with it, it's very difficult to remove myself from that illusion of self. And that's why the body mindfulness takes pride of place in the Buddhist explanations over all the other foundations of mindfulness. So watching the body and seeing, well, do I really own it now that it's, for a few moments, it may be providing some pleasure. So I'm happy to own it. And then it provides some discomfort. So now I'm unhappy to own it. So why should I put myself into this kind of difficulty? Sometimes I'm happy to own it, other times I'm unhappy to own it. Can't I just stand back and look at it and say, well, it has arisen through craving, it keeps on living through food, and it is a manifestation, just like all manifestations in creation, and consists of bits and pieces and of the four elements. if you tell yourself that often enough, you eventually believe it. In the beginning, it's just something that you may act, affirm, but you don't feel it. But if you do it often enough, you feel it. It's just the body. That's all. The reason that everybody thinks it's their body, that causes all this feeling. That also causes the fear of death, huh? Because it's me. And it also causes this totally wrong idea. I mentioned that the other day to somebody, that one shouldn't give people painkillers because their awareness disappears. Nonsense. Their awareness is there when they're dead too. It doesn't disappear at all. Not to have painkillers for somebody who's in pain and to die with pain is counterproductive, totally counterproductive, because it's the mind goes very negative and goes into a state of unhappiness, and that's no way to die. So the awareness, when you have painkillers to a great extent, the change is that in the reaction, people can't react the way they usually do. They can't talk back to you and probably can't see you, but the awareness is there. I mean, it's still there when you're dead. So why should it be there when you've taken a painkiller? I think maybe this kind of a nonsensical idea is slowly diminishing when people are getting a little more aware of this sort of thing. And it still has to do with the total identification with the body. And not being aware of the fact that awareness in the mind is something entirely different from the body. And we don't have